something about more about the family history. I don't think there would be much political discussions between this part of the family and that part. He was kind of a CIA academic.
Yes. Well, we will leave it there. Evand Abrahamian, thanks so much for being with us. Retired professor of history at Baruch College, City University of New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Self-Care Day of Celebration, July 24th from 4 to 7 p.m. at World Pulse in Portland. Hosted by advocate and author Della Ray, this Self-Care Day of Celebration includes exhibitors, food and drink, interactive stations, and is a reminder to encourage the practice of self-care. Again, that's the Self-Care Day of Celebration on July 24th from 4 to 7 p.m. at World Pulse Headquarters, 411 Northeast 19th Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Report from Kabul speech by Zahair Wahab on Wednesday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House in Portland. Zahair Wahab, a native of Afghanistan and director of graduate studies at the American University of Afghanistan, will present a critical analysis of the Afghani political, military, economic, and cultural situation. Again, that's Report from Kabul by Zahair Wahab on Wednesday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, 4312 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Willamette River Festival and Movie in the Park, Sunday, July 30th from 1 to 10 p.m. at the Cathedral Park waterfront in Portland. The Willamette River Festival is a celebration on the waterfront with live music by Shanghaied on the Willamette, Norman Sylvester, and more, as well as a beer garden, food carts, an environmental fair, DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid, and more. Again, that's the Willamette River Festival and Movie in the Park, Sunday, July 30th from 1 to 10 p.m. at the Cathedral Park waterfront in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis. And today is Monday, July 24th, and this is More Talk Radio. I am Cecil Prescott. In 2016, 1.53 million people were held in prisons in the United States. The United States has the second highest prisons population rate in the world, second to a small country on the East Coast. In the Indian Ocean, Seychelles. Today's guest is an activist who is engaged in a movement to reduce the U.S. prison population by one half. We are joined this morning by Jessica Jackson Sloan, who is the national director and co-founder of #Cut50, a bipartisan effort to cut the U.S. prison population in half. We'll talk today about her work and about how we, you, may participate in this important human rights struggle. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us. I I suppose I want to begin by asking how you and why did you become involved in this movement to reduce the prison population?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I come to this from both a personal as well as a professional angle. When I was 22 years old, I stood in a courtroom holding my two-month-old daughter and watching my husband get sentenced to 15 years to serve six. He ended up serving 3.5 of those years down in Georgia, and it ripped our family apart. So I saw how broken the system really was to take somebody who is no danger to society, although struggling from an addiction himself, and instead of getting him treatment, to put him in a cage and throw away the key and traumatize him even further. So I decided to get involved and went to college and law school, became a public defender, and eventually met Van Jones and founded Cut 50.
That's fascinating in terms of how you became involved because of how your family was impacted by the legal system. And tell us about Cut 50. How did you and Mr. Jones come up with this project?
Well, I'll say first, you know, it began. My sort of resentment of the system and anger with the system began when I saw my own family impacted. But throughout the course of my husband's incarceration, I met so many families, whether it was in the visiting rooms or otherwise, that were going through the same thing, that had also been really badly impacted by the system. And I just got this overall sense, you know, I wasn't alone in this struggle. It was the entire system was broken. So it started with just my family, but really I feel strongly that, you know, all the work we're doing is to represent all of the families out there of the 2.2 million people who are incarcerated right now here in the United States. I met Van Jones at a Democratic Central Committee dinner here in Marin County, California.
Mm-hmm.
He and I got to talking, and he had previously worked on criminal justice issues. At the time, I was representing death row inmates and their appeals. And we got to talking, and I was sort of joking around with him. I didn't realize it was going to go anywhere. I sort of told him, you know, it's nice you're doing environmental work, but there's still people in cages.
Yes.
And I think it really struck a chord with him. It made him think about, you know, the work he was doing and what he wanted to continue to do during his career. So we ended up talking after that and brought another friend of ours in, Matt Haney, who's on the school board here in San Francisco, just to talk about, you know, what broader policies we could push for. And within 6 months, we actually were working with a range of people I never thought I would ever work with, everybody from Newt Gingrich to Cory Booker to Tulsi Gabbard to the Koch brothers themselves. To end mass incarceration on a federal level, and this year we began our work on the state level as well.
We're speaking this morning with Jessica Jackson Sloan, who is a national director and co-founder of hashtag Cut50, which is a bipartisan effort, as you just heard her mention some of the people involved in this movement, to cut the U.S. prison population in half. We will take your phone calls during this morning if you have questions or comments, and our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Now, you mentioned this bipartisan effort. Why do you think that there is a movement of people across the political spectrum and ideological spectrum to address the prison population? And maybe first, describe what is this broken system? How did we get here, and why are millions of people incarcerated?
Yeah. Believe it or not, it actually starts back in Nixon's days. I pulled up the other day a propaganda campaign video of his talking about, you know, the wave of crime that was hitting the U.S. and the need for stricter laws. It continued to build policy-wise through both Reagan and the Bushes and Bill Clinton as well, with something known as the War on Drugs.
Yes.
Policies that criminalized use of drugs, sale of drugs, and really went after people with extremely long sentences that, again, don't result in treating the underlying issue, which oftentimes is addiction or poverty or lack of opportunity, but instead just puts people in cages and forces the taxpayers to pay, you know, upwards of $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year for these people to sit there and not get help. So the war on drugs was extremely detrimental to our prison population size. It just ballooned over the 80s and 90s. I think that the effect of that is what's causing this bipartisan coalition to really come together. What we're seeing is, you know, folks on both sides of the aisle do have humanitarian reasons why they want to get people out. Many people we work with on both sides of the aisle, you know, have noticed the extreme trauma this is causing communities, especially African-American communities, where, you know, one out of three men is expected to spend some time in jail or prison during their life, which means, you know, that's another household without a father or brother or son in it contributing. We've got, you know, a good group of evangelicals who believe that this is the right thing to do, is to give people second chances and not discount their humanity and throw them in a cage forever just because they've made a bad decision. We've got a lot of governors across the country who are looking at their balance sheets. And I'll tell you, mass incarceration costs this country $80 billion a year. Billion with a B.
Yes.
Which is money that could be going into education or health care or infrastructure, anything, you know, besides just, you know, putting people in prisons. So we've got governors who are trying to balance their state budgets. We've got legislators who are seeing this as a huge waste of money. We've got libertarians who think this is a, you know, overbloated system with no accountability. And then we've got common sense, which says, you know, we're spending $80 billion a year on a system that's actually failing 74% of the time, because 90% of that 2.2 million people are actually going to come home at some point. And currently, because there is such a lack of rehabilitation and a lack of addressing the actual underlying reason people are committing crimes, 74% of them are going back in, recidivating. So it's a broken system. It's extremely expensive, and that money could be spent better making our streets safer and preventing crime.
And so in a strange, maybe redemptive twist, what was seen as a bipartisan effort to, as you mentioned, the war on crime, has morphed into an awareness that effort doesn't work, and that it's impacting many communities, brown and black communities in particular, but across the board. And interestingly enough, I think, you know, in recent months, I heard a different tactic in addressing drugs, in terms of, maybe because the drug epidemic has reached beyond those in inner cities, but an effort to look at ways, rather than incarceration, to emphasize treatment as a way to address some of the social impacts of drugs. Tell us a little bit more about some campaigns that you have, and you mentioned Senator Booker, and I understand he is a co-sponsor of something your organization working on, Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act.
Absolutely. We're very excited to have had Senator Booker's support from day one at Cut 50. He's just been an incredible leader, willing to speak out, you know, both from his own perspective in the Senate, but also from his time as mayor of a community. He's had to make some tough decisions around how to deal with crime, and knows what it's like to be responsible for a community and want to ensure their public safety. So He's been a great supporter from day one. I was very honored to go to D.C. 2 weeks ago and stand with him and Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren, as we introduced the Dignity for Incarcerated Women's Act. This is a bill that applies on the federal level. And some of the things I say might shock you, that we have to have a bill in 2017 to fix, but it would end the practice of shackling pregnant women while they're in labor. It would end the practice of keeping women in solitary confinement simply for being pregnant. It would end the difficult choice that mothers in prison must go through of whether to buy the hygiene items they need on a monthly basis, tampons or sanitary pads, or call home to their kids. Yes, they have to buy their own sanitary items. It would decrease the cost of calling home to their kids and video visitation, because oftentimes they get moved all around the country. They don't stay in the same state where their children are. So it would also take into account that dilemma and try and keep them close to their kids as possible. And then finally, the women's population in prison is largely women who have been sexually traumatized. They estimate about 90% of the women in prison have been sexually abused. So we literally have a sexual abuse to prison pipeline. Despite this shocking fact and the care and sensitivity it deserves, the Bureau of Prisons has a practice of allowing male guards to be in the bathrooms when the women are in state of undress. So whether they're in the showers or going to the bathroom, male guards are walking around. So this bill would end the practice of letting male guards come in the bathrooms while the women are naked, unless there was some sort of an emergency. Instead, it would require that female guards be the ones to supervise showering and bathroom time.
And this would impact federal prisons and not state prison, this legislation?
This would impact federal prisons, but what we're hoping is that it sends a strong message to the states. And some of them have already ended some of these provisions. Like California, we no longer think it's okay to shackle a woman while she's in labor. So some of these states already have taken measures to prevent these acts from going on within their prisons. But we're hoping for the others that it motivates them to really look at how they're treating women in prisons and make sure that they are treating them with dignity and respect that all women deserve.
You're listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, and KBOO.FM everywhere else here on More Talk Radio. With regard to prisons reforming who patrols who, and especially the changes you mentioned with regard to labor. Cecil asked about federal prisons versus state, but I'm curious, are these still affecting privately run prisons?
Yes. So this would still have this would have implications on any Bureau of Prison inmates. So anybody who's incarcerated by the Bureau of Prisons, whether that's in a private prison or in a federal prison, this would have an impact on them. And I should point out, you know, private prisons get a lot of attention, and rightfully so, because they're so poorly run. But I do want to point out, you know, most people have an issue with private prisons because of the fact that they're profiting off of incarceration of individuals. And, you know, one of the biggest misnomers in the field is that it's the private prisons that profit, but not the state prisons. And what the truth is the state prisons have contracts with all sorts of companies, whether it's Global Tellink, who charges, you know, upwards of $21 per phone call for 15 minutes, or if it's JPay, who will charge a fee so that, you know, people can put money on their loved ones' books to buy items on commissary, or if it's, you know, the commissary services themselves, or Aramark that's providing the food, or, you know, the folks providing the laundry. They're all making extreme profits and price gouging us, the taxpayers, to pay for it.
And you had mentioned earlier that the cost for incarceration, mass incarceration, was astronomical. And so I'm wondering, is there any motivation legislatively to try to capture some of this money by reducing these costs beyond folks having to legislate for human rights?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the more we're starting to address the fact that the current system fails to achieve the most basic goal of rehabilitating people because of the lack of focus on any programs that actually do rehabilitate people or any treatment options, the more we're starting to focus on those factors and legislate around sentencing reform or diversion programs such as drug courts or veterans courts that have extremely high rates of success, the more we're seeing, you know, the prison population fall. In Texas, just this year, they announced that they're going to be closing another 4 prisons, which brings us to a total of 8 this last 10 years, because their prison population is decreasing as they're starting to implement more and more diversion programs and sentencing reform, and they'll have another 1,755 beds that are empty, so they're able to close those prisons. And what's interesting is they actually also put out a report saying, interestingly enough, that crime has fallen as they're decreasing the prisons. So we know that actually addressing the underlying cause of crime versus putting people in prisons is working to make our streets safer.
We welcome your calls to speak with Jessica Jackson here on More Talk Radio as we discuss the ways that are working to reduce the prison population, the will to reduce prison population, and the ways maybe you can get involved. 503-231-8187. And we'll go to Marion, who's been waiting. Thank you so much.
Hi. Thank you for this program and all the things you're focusing on, I'm aware of, and they're really great. I wonder if you've also taken into consideration letting elderly prisoners out. I am personally acquainted with a prisoner in New York State who was sentenced to 25 years to life. He's now 79 years old, has a lot of health problems, walks with a cane, and they will not let him out on parole because they say he's a threat to society. And in 2012, the ACLU did a study about the cost of elderly prisoners, and at that time it was between $68,000 and $100,000 a year. I mean, it's probably more 5 years later now. So I wanted to hear your thought about that. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for your question, Marion. You raise a very important point, and that is, you know, not just the cost of incarcerating the elderly, but the purpose of it. What we know is that people actually age out of committing crimes. There is a significant drop in the number of crimes that elderly people commit. There's also a desire for compassionate release for those who are getting close to the end of their lives. And then I would argue, you know, there's also a significant argument to be made that we're actually hurting the chances of reentry and successful reintegration for somebody if we're keeping them in there into their 70s, right? So, for example, I know a kid, he's now a man, here in California, who at 17 years old was sentenced to 54 to life. When you give a 17-year-old that sort of a sentence, one, you're taking away their hope. Two, you're taking away any sort of opportunity for them to have a meaningful career or contribute to society or be able to participate in society, really. So when they come out and they're in their late 60s, early 70s, they don't really have a whole lot of choices. They might not qualify for some of the public services that we need, you know, as elderly. So then they're, you know, left in abject poverty with no options. They certainly have a hard time getting into any sort of meaningful work if they physically even could get into work force at that age. So, you know, I have long advocated both for compassionate release of those who are elderly, but also for sentencing reform for those who are entering the system and being given these incredibly long sentences of multiple decades.
Yeah, really. And actually, compassionate release is almost non-existent anymore. I mean, you've got to be on your deathbed before they'll let you out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Marianne, for sharing that important point. We are speaking with Jessica Jackson of Cut 50, a bipartisan effort to cut the U.S. prison population, and we invite your calls, questions, and comments here at KBOO Community Radio. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, George.
Good morning.
Good morning. And I want to just bring up a historical footnote. I don't want to divert this conversation for very long at all from what happened in the 1950s after the CIA was formed. But I do want to mention that one of the things that was used to put an awful lot of people in prison, especially African-American people, was their involvement with various kinds of illegal narcotics. But when we look back at that era, we find that the CIA had a very large program to bring illegal narcotics into this country in the 1950s and 60s. And I'll just mention a book by Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey Sinclair. It's called Whiteout, and it's a history of, like, the CIA's, 50-year involvement in bringing illegal drugs into the country, and then seeing to it that the police blamed the black people for it. Anyway, I just think it's very important to go back to what you've been talking about here, but I wanted to mention this. It's a horrible, horrible, deliberate thing, I think. Anyway, I'd be interested in what you think about it, but I don't want to... The present situation is far more in our laps right now.
Jessica, maybe you might respond, and also you mentioned earlier in terms of this bipartisan effort to reform prisoning. Has there been a turn in thinking about how we address crime and how we address the underlying cause? And does your organization work on those issues as well?
Yeah, I think there has been a turn because we've seen what we're doing is not successful and not actually increasing public safety. So there's definitely been a huge turn in how we're addressing crime, and we're starting to look more and more at evidence-based methods. For example, the drug courts. I mentioned them earlier. These are courts that, quite frankly, would have held my family together and would have resulted in my husband getting the help he needed, while my daughter having her father around and me having another financial source in the house so that we could actually make our bills and provide for our daughter. We see that they are about 70%+ effective in getting a person off of drugs and making sure that they don't recidivate, they don't commit any other crimes, at least in the first 5 years, which is, you know, sort of the danger zone. There's a popular misconception that drug courts are just for people who have been caught with drugs, but actually many drug courts focus on anybody who has committed a crime, sometimes even violent crimes. I met a guy who had successfully completed a drug court program that had assaulted a police officer and been given the second chance of drug court because he was intoxicated at the time, and he was able to get off of drugs and turn his life around and go to school and, you know, become quite successful in his chosen field. We see veterans courts hopping up across the country. These are also courts that treat the underlying issue by actually having people in the room who can talk about job training, who can talk about mental health resources, who can match them up with mentors and really get them the support they need as they've come home from, you know, a difficult time overseas in the war, and really make sure that they're getting back on their feet and reintegrating into society. That brings me to reentry courts, which are something new that are kind of being started across the country and really focus on people who are coming home from prison, either as an alternative to parole or as an addition to their probation. They're getting to go through these reentry courts that are really trying to match them with the services they need to find jobs and housing and other treatment services. So I think we're definitely starting to see a huge movement towards diverting people out of the system. We're starting to see a movement towards decreasing sentences for people who are being convicted of crimes, even if they are being put in. We're seeing a huge movement towards ending money bail, which is an unfair practice that disproportionately impacts the poor, obviously, as they can't make their bail and are forced to sit in jail, sometimes even over a couple of $100 of bail that they can't afford. So we're starting to see people move in the right direction, and I'm excited about all the progress.
One of the questions that really, for me, underlies some of these unfair practices, and you've alluded to it many times, and that is the underlying profit motive. The fact that in some states, in some municipalities, through some for-profit institutions, prisons rather, I should say, there's a lot of money to be made. The telephone companies, everything. Everybody's got some profit motive for this. And what I'm wondering is, will municipalities fight because they're worrying about losing that additional revenue, or are they going to be, or have they been more swayable because they realize the value of another human being, both to society and potentially to their economy? Because one of the things that a lot of us remember who are a little older is the fact that when people are in prison, they're expected to work, and there are a lot of contracts that go to prisons, whether it be call centers or making clothes or, you know, both as a joke and seriously pressing license plates, you know, things like that. So I'm just wondering how easy it is to break that financial dependence.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is largely an issue for private industry fighting the reform efforts, and I haven't seen too much of it, but I do expect that it will come, as well as a lot of the unions, the prison guard unions. Mm-hmm. You know, they're worried about their folks. They don't want to lose their jobs, which is understandable, but, you know, it will happen as we're starting to close prisons and divert people elsewhere. So I think it's important to remember them and you know, ways for them to be able to provide an income to their family. Think about what we're going to do with the displaced people who no longer have jobs as we're closing prisons. But ultimately, we're just really focused on getting the prison doors shut. In terms of the working contracts, you know, I know this firsthand. My husband was an electrician. He made $35 an hour with money we could actually support our family on in Georgia. However, when he was incarcerated, doing exactly the same thing, because they realized early on he had a skill and that he could be of use to the Department of Corrections down in Georgia, they were only paying him 52 cents an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I work with guys here in San Quentin Prison that get paid 13 cents an hour. So, you know, it is very unfortunate. There are a lot of companies that are profiting off of basically, you know, prison labor, and we are working on that a little bit at Cut 50 just to expose it, but there's actually a really great movie that my co-founder Van Jones is in that came out last year called The 13th, and it's,
yes,
by Ava DuVernay. You can find it on Netflix, and it really goes into great detail for those who are wanting to learn more about this issue.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Jessica Jackson of Cut 50, a bipartisan effort to cut the U.S. prison population, which includes people across the political spectrum and ideological divide that often makes it difficult to make legislation possible. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, and we'll take your calls. And we have a caller online. Good morning, Francis.
Good morning.
Hi, I appreciate your conversation this morning and your guest, that Miss Jackson.
Yes.
It sounds like we share a similar introduction into the criminal justice system when my husband went to prison many, 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 many moons ago. And it is really true that there isn't much discussion on how that alienation affects the children as they grow older. The whole concept of prisons is something that I've been looking at, and there's a few people who are doing some research on different approaches. And I know when you talk about the police, and just last the show you just had, Democracy Now, they spoke about how police actually started were to keep slaves on the plantation. And that's their beginning in this country, police departments, patrols, and so forth. And when you think about how people are in their initial contact with the criminal justice system, and a lot of times it is with the police officer, and that can determine whether they're even charged or what they're charged with. All kinds of things happen after that. Okay. But I can recall many moons ago when I was visiting my husband on a regular basis, okay, I had conversations with Hoyt Cupp, who was the superintendent of Oregon State Prison. And he admitted to me and acknowledged that probably 90% of the people in that prison didn't really need to be there. They were not a threat to anybody, but they were there doing time for whatever they were charged with.
Yeah.
And the whole notion, and your guest, you have mentioned several times about putting people in cages. And I'm beginning to wonder if there's any excuse ever to put anybody in a cage for anything. Is that the only thing that we can come up with or think about? And I'm wondering if there's any discussion other than just alternatives to the court. Is there any discussion at all about maybe finding another way to deal with a lot of these so-called crimes?
Yeah.
And also the...
Wait, Francis. Let's give her a chance to answer a couple of those. Those are good questions.
If you want to answer my question, then I'll just make a statement, and I can take your answer off the line. I just wanted to say that there's a lot of communities, such as Ontario, Oregon, where Snake River Correctional Institution is, that are dependent upon the money that comes into that community because of the prison. And they also get funds for the minority population that lives in their prison, although when those minority people leave that prison, they're not going to be living there. So anyway, if you can answer those questions, I'd appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much, Frances. You have a lot of information. Jessica.
Yeah, so there was a lot there. I'll do my best to answer it all. When it comes to, you know, the fact that I say people in cages, I mean, having been inside of the prisons for the last, I don't know, 11 years, that's literally what it is. It's cages.
Yes.
You walk in and you might have, you know, 5 by 7 foot that two people are sharing, and, you know, there's metal cage for a door. So I love using that word because I want to be clear about what we are doing.
Yes.
Is there something that we could be doing better, even for those who, you know, maybe need to be in prison for a little while, maybe need a little bit of time away from the community to work on themselves? Yes, absolutely. And we really don't have to speculate what that system would be. We know what it is. It's tried and true out in the Netherlands, out in Sweden, Norway, where they actually treat people like human beings, even when they're incarcerated. They have their own room. They're given, you know, a lot more freedoms than we give our prisoners here. And they also do a lot better when they get out. They have about a 14% recidivism rate. So whereas we have somewhere around 74%, they have 14%. And that's not because, you know, the Northern Europeans are so much more civilized. It's because they're actually treating people like people throughout the system, and day one starts their rehabilitation and reentry plan, and they talk about job skills, and they have therapy, and they address mental health issues and addiction issues, and really look at it holistically as a process in which they're trying to help the person heal and get back on their feet, as opposed to just putting them in a cage and punishing them for an act with an arbitrary amount of time. So, you know, I've met a lot of people in prison, that 90% number of folks who shouldn't be there. I'm not sure where that comes from, but I've met so many people who would be doing great things, who are doing great things in prison and would be doing, you know, even more to help the communities on the outside if they were out here.
So, you know, once upon a time, when we talk about U.S. prisons, we remember the time of, it was a maybe started by people like Quakers. It was a time where people had time to reflect and reform their lives. And you mentioned that there, you know, are people in prison who need time to work on themselves. Is that happening in our prisons, and why is it not? In terms of prisons as a place for people to work and better themselves and to change?
Well, I'll tell you, it's happening in some prisons. It's not happening in anywhere near enough. I have the fortune of being here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I get to go to San Quentin Prison once or twice a week and work with guys there who, by the way, a lot of their work, their stories, and their media project are on our website, cut50.org. Yes. If you'd like to see more about some of the work we're doing in the prison, you can visit that site. But I do get to work with the guys inside San Quentin Prison, and it's, you know, more or less a model prison when it comes to rehabilitation and programming, because they actually have access to programming. Most states are choosing not to fund rehabilitation and programming, and these are programs that not only deal with job skills, but also ones that really have the guys working on themselves, have them, you know, doing victim offender dialogue with people who are crime survivors, or have them engaging in really dissecting where their own emotional rage is coming from and how to turn that rage into power. Or talking about, you know, how to really take accountability for their actions and move forward and transform themselves. So there's a lot of programs that we know are extremely successful and work, and they're, you know, implemented in some prisons, and those prisons have a much lower rate of recidivism than others. But many, many, many prisons, I would say the vast majority of prisons, simply are places where we warehouse people, further traumatize them. They're overcrowded. They don't have access to adequate health or mental health care. Poor nutrition, you know, extreme violence going on in the prisons because people don't have anything else to do while they're there. So I would say that the model programs that help people really work through what happened and where they're going next are too few and too far between.
They are too few and too far between, and your organization is working on addressing these, Cut 50. We're speaking with Jessica Jackson, a co-founder and director of Cut 50, which is seeking to reduce the prison population by 50%. One thing unique about your organization is that you're working on bipartisan means of addressing some of these issues. And recently you wrote about something that your senator from California, Senator Harris, and Senator Ron Paul, Rand Paul, are working on to address some of these issues. And this a Pretrial Integrity and Safety Act. Could you say something about that?
Yes, I'll start by just sort of, it's a fancy title for something that we all know to be, you know, the bail industry. So when you're arrested, you're taken into the station, you're booked in on whatever the crime you're alleged to have done is, and you're either taken in front of a judge right away, it's called an arraignment, to set an amount of money that they think will drive you to come back to court, your bail, or sometimes you're released on recognizance, or sometimes you put up your house or another property to commit to coming back to the court proceedings. What we've found through this is that people who can't afford to make their bail, maybe their bail is only a few hundred dollars, but they can't afford to pay it, are ending up sitting in jails until the time of their trial, which can be 60-plus days. Now, if you think about it, what happens to you if you don't show up for work for 60 days or even a week? You're probably going to lose your job. Mm. What happens if you lose your job? You might lose your housing. Most likely, you're going to lose your housing. If you lose your housing and your job, maybe you even lose custody of your children. You end up getting to such a difficult position of homelessness, joblessness, family problems, possibly, you know, turning to drugs or alcohol to help with the pain of all this. And you haven't even been convicted of a crime yet.
Right.
So, you know, I've seen people who sat in jails for months waiting on trials. I've also, unfortunately, seen people who said, I'm innocent, but you know what? I can't sit here any longer. I'm just going to take a plea, yes, and that way I will be able to get out of here. I'll be eligible to get out of here. So, you know, we have seen the detrimental impacts of bail. We know that even being incarcerated for as many as 3 days can be detrimental to people's lives in terms of their jobs and their housing and whatnot. So that's why I'm really proud to see this act coming forward and many of the end money bail efforts going on around the country that look to address this issue and use risk assessment tools instead of financial barriers to decide who can come home from jail after being arrested.
We're speaking.
Well, I was both caught because I had a question and I looked at the time. We want to encourage your phone calls, your conversation with us here at More Talk Radio. Our guest is Jessica Jackson. We're talking about ways of cutting the U.S. prison population by 50%. The phone number is 503-231-8187. And one of the things that fascinates me is how people are really passionate about this and able to stay engaged, although, as you've mentioned, we're dealing with some pretty... I'm going to say unprofitable in a moral sense, some unprofitable treatment of human beings that we know both in terms of scientific evidence and anecdotal observation doesn't really rehabilitate people. How do you stay encouraged in the midst of this big challenge?
That's a really good question, and it's actually one that I don't get asked that often. This is a huge challenge. There are a lot of people in the field that are fighting for reforms right now because we want to see our community safer, and we understand how this is hurting people and hurting society as a whole. And I think it's easy to get discouraged, right? We lose more than we win. We see the pain firsthand all the time of what's happening. But I'm really fortunate because, like I said before, you know, I go in the prison every week and I get to work with an incredible group of individuals that are just so talented and so amazing and so insightful. And, you know, they recharge me. They re-energize my will to continue fighting. I remember the personal pain that I went through when my own husband was incarcerated, and I hear the stories from the guys and the women that we work with, you know, about their families, and you can just hear the pain in their voices, and it motivates you to keep going and work harder. No amount of work is anywhere near the amount of pain that they feel from these circumstances. So I'm lucky to have that direct contact and seeing as close as I can to the voice of those who are impacted and just holding that and keeping that with me at all times.
So to kind of follow up on that, and especially when we talk about putting people in cages, but also we talk about people having time to reflect upon their behavior, their triggers, and their choices, could you share maybe a story of someone who's been incarcerated who made that transition from being a violent person to recognizing and owning their life?
Yeah, I'm happy to do so. I don't tell his story as well as he does, but I'll point you to the story of Shaka Sengor. I hired Shaka 2.5 years ago to the Cut 50 team. He was 19 years old when he took somebody else's life during a drug deal. He spent the next 20 years in prison in Detroit, where, you know, I think he was reluctant at first to really do any sort of self-examination and looking at himself or looking at, you know, the circumstances that led him there. He'd had a very traumatic childhood and was very, very angry. After receiving a letter from his son about, you know, his incarceration, Shaka ended up really getting into writing and journaling and figuring out sort of where had he been and where was he going to go. And he realized, you know, for his son's sake and his own, that he needed to make some significant changes in who he was. So again, we talk about programming in prisons. Shaka's an exceptional human being. There wasn't this kind of programming in his prison, but while in solitary confinement, he took it upon himself to start writing and gave himself a deadline for writing a book. I think he gave himself 30 days, which is nothing.
Wow. That's
to write a book.
Yeah.
And he ended up coming out, and he had that book with him. It's called Righting My Wrongs, and last year it became a New York Times bestseller after he gave, I think, the most listened to TED Talk of anybody who's formerly incarcerated, and was interviewed on Oprah's show, in which she called his interview one of the top 5 interviews she had done in her career. So just extremely meaningful work that he took on himself. And we are very fortunate because we've been able to sort of follow that journey by reading his book, Righting My Wrongs.
Well, that's a very powerful story, and it's one tale of many. I'm wondering if you... and we received an earlier caller who shared something about her family struggle with the prison system. What do we do with families who are impacted by prisoners? Are there ways in which your work can encourage them?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, on March 1st of this year, we set out with 2,000 volunteers in person in 35 different states to talk to over 500 state legislators. And we weren't necessarily pushing for any particular policies. We were just telling the stories of those who have been impacted. And when I say those who have been impacted, the children of the incarcerated, formerly incarcerated, but also, just as important, crime survivors and murder victim families and law enforcement who are impacted every day by crime and by a broken system that's creating more crime instead of keeping us safer. So we set out, we called it the Day of Empathy. We went and spoke to all these legislators and simply shared our stories and used our voices to really let them know, you know, hey, this system is broken and we need reform. We need you to be actively looking for ways to reduce the prison population and make our streets safer. It was a huge hit. We have been asked to do it again next year, and we're actually now formed the Empathy Network, which you can find out about on our website, cut50.org. And you can sign up to participate in the next Day of Empathy, either as a volunteer or as somebody who's been impacted, and to come out and talk to your state legislators, partake in the storytelling workshops, partake in the media training, really start getting the word out there about the impacts of incarceration and how detrimental it is to families.
Now, you said this was a national event. Are there local organizations that work with Cut 50, so people here in Portland, Oregon, or elsewhere can join in?
Yes, and if you go to that website, cut50.org, and look at the Day of Empathy, we actually partnered with a local organization in every state. So if you go and you click on Oregon, you'll see who our partner was there. I believe it was Dave's Killer Bread, a great group that is doing a lot of work to help improve reentry and get industries to hire formerly incarcerated individuals, as well as taking a look at some of the policies that are ongoing there. We're also going to have more partners next year, and organizations who wish to be a partner can sign up through our website on there.
Great. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community connection, KBOO Portland. And we've only got maybe enough time for maybe one or two more calls if you're interested in joining in the conversation at 503-231-8187 to speak with Jessica Jackson of Cut 50. And coming up,
Is the Omo Variety Hour at 9. They will include a discussion with the Portland Chapter of Democratic Socialists of America, plus Walden Bellow insists that it's not only necessary to develop an alternative to globalization, it's entirely possible. At 10 Locus Focus, visits with 350 PDX to look at the potential court battle over Portland's fossil fuel infrastructure ban. At 11 is Disability Awareness and a discussion with Disability Rights Oregon about the looming threats to Medicare. At 11:30, Voices for the Animals talk to the founder of Climate Healers about his plan that calls for reconnecting to all living things in order to address climate change. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. But right now, here on More Talk Radio, we are talking with our fantastic guest, Jessica Jackson, about Cut 50 and about their plans to cut prison population by 50% in 10 years. Is it doable, Jessica?
Absolutely. We've seen New York City do it. We're watching Texas and Georgia on their way to doing it.
Which is impressive. Texas, of all states. That should encourage a lot of people.
Yes, if Texas can do it, anybody can do it. So one of the first people I met in this bipartisan fight and who came out and spoke at our bipartisan summit was Governor Rick Perry. And I'm sure a lot of folks cringe when they hear that. But, you know, at the time I was representing death row inmates, and there was nobody in the world that I probably could think I would work less with than Governor Rick Perry. But he actually began to enact...
Oh, did we lose her?
Well, we might have lost Jessica Jackson for a minute, but she was talking about Cut 50, about her work with Rick Perry, who is then governor of Texas, now secretary of the Department of Energy. But we want you to go to their website, cut50.org, and participate in many ways. You can donate and you can work in their with them, not only locally but nationally. The prison population is something that we are working with tirelessly and endlessly here. We want to reduce mass incarceration. Cut 50 is working to reduce the prison population by 50% in 10 years by engaging with people across the ideological and political spectrum. We want to thank Jessica for joining us this morning.
And also, we want to encourage you to become active and support organizations that help not only cut prison populations, reduce mass incarcerations, but improve conditions for those who are incarcerated so that they can come out as whole people and be able to productively contribute to society, which makes us all whole. This is your Community Connection, KBOO, Portland. And don't forget, we also have Prison Pipeline here. It's one of our wonderful programs made possible by you, KBOO members.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. This month, the Finance Committee will meet Monday, July 24th at 4:30 p.m. KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Self-Care Day of Celebration, July 24th from 4 to 7 p.m. at World Pulse in Portland. Hosted by advocate and author Della Ray, this Self-Care Day of Celebration includes exhibitors, food and drink, interactive stations, and is a reminder to encourage the practice of self-care. Again, that's the Self-Care Day of Celebration on July 24th from 4 to 7 p.m. at World Pulse Headquarters, 411 Northeast 19th Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland. Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming.